Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends. Brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Zalila Harris, author of the New York Times bestselling novel, The Other Black Girl.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written 7 books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television.
Today, we'll be discussing Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, whose work very much reflected her rural Florida home. She's best known for The Yearling, which is a book about a boy who adopts a pet deer. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1939 and was made into a well-known film starring Gregory Peck.
December 16th, 1953, New York Times. Mrs. Rawlings, 57, novelist, is dead. St. Augustine, Florida. Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, whose story of a Florida backwoods boy won the Pulitzer Prize in 1939, died of cerebral hemorrhage last night in Flagler Hospital. She was taken ill yesterday morning. The death of the 57-year-old novelist cut short her work on a new project, The Life of Ellen Glasgow, the Virginia novelist. Mrs. Rawlings had planned to devote 5 years of research and writing to it. For more than 10 years, Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings tried hard to become a fiction writer with complete failure. She made up her mind to give up. Then I thought, well, just one more, she told a New York Times reporter years later. That short story, she said, sold like a shot, and I have had no trouble since. No Trouble was a modest understatement for a success that included a Pulitzer Prize novel and 2 others in final consideration for the award, 2 honorary college degrees, and a fortune in book club royalties and movie rights. The Yearling, Mrs. Rawlings' greatest triumph, was hailed in 1938 as a classic of American popular fiction. While considering her writing as lacking the depth and tough-mindedness of great literature, critics nevertheless praised her skill in reproducing the color, characters, speech, local customs, and way of life of the backwoods of Florida. Marjorie Kinnan was born on August 8, 1896 in Washington, where her father, Arthur Frank Kinnan, was a patent attorney for the government. The girl acquired her knowledge of farm life early by spending her holidays on the family farm in Maryland.
After college, she worked during World War I as a publicity agent for the Young Women's Christian Association headquarters in Washington. In 1919, she was married to Charles Rawlings, also a writer. They were divorced 14 years later. For 10 years, Mrs. Rawlings was a reporter for the Louisville Courier Journal and the Rochester Journal, and wrote syndicated verse for United Features. All during these journalistic years, she also was toiling at short stories, but sold not a one. In 1928, Mrs. Rawlings retired on a 72-acre orange farm she had bought in the remote swamps of north central Florida near the hamlet of Hawthorne, which she had discovered on a visit to her in-laws. There, she persevered until Jacob's Ladder won a novelette contest in Scribner's Magazine in 1931. After that first success, another short story, Gal Youngin, won an O. Henry Memorial Prize in 1933, and she sent her first novel, South Moon Under, to Scribner's. All these works were regional to her Florida home. The late Max Perkins, Scribner's great editor and talent scout, directed the rewriting of South Moon Under, and it became a Book of the Month Club selection in 1933. Golden Apples almost won the Pulitzer Prize in 1935. The Yearling did win it in 1939. The sentimental story, telling how a 12-year-old boy grows up to the harsh facts of life by accepting the necessity for his pet deer to be killed, has sold hundreds of thousands of copies in many editions and was made into a popular Technicolor film. Mrs. Rawlings wrote a nonfiction book about her farm, Cross Creek, another Book of the Month choice, in 1942, and a Florida cookbook the same year. She left the swamps briefly for Upper New York State, producing The Sojourner, a novel, last year. But it was the Florida of hammock trees and palmetto and alligator hunters that made Mrs. Rawlings famous. When one hears the term Florida cracker, one thinks at once of her work, the Times commented. She did not produce a great deal in 22 years, considering the demand for her every line. Writing is agony for me, she once told an interviewer. I work at it 8 hours every day, hoping to get 6 pages, but I'm satisfied with 3.
So, Zakiya, what is your experience of Marjorie, and I'm guessing probably the yearling specifically.
Non-existent. Like, mm-hmm. I think I definitely had heard of the yearling, of course. I think anyone who's a reader, not anyone who's a reader, who am I to say that? But I think a lot of schools do read it.
Yeah.
And we talk about a little bit later in the interview about its kind of YA status, mm-hmm. Today anyways. And I definitely did not read it, but maybe another class might have read it in my elementary school or later on in life. And I think, but it also makes me think of other stories like it, like Where the Red Fern Grows, which did not read, but does have animals who unfortunately passed.
And animals are dying all the time in this genre is my main insight to the, yes. in thinking about this, especially deer, but
yeah,
like it yes. reminds me of Bambi too, right? Like,
yeah.
We're constantly like, there's this like emotionally manipulative, not that this is that, but like trope, right? Old Yeller. Yeah.
Old Yeller for sure. For sure. And we don't, I mean, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but that trope's not really one around now.
That's how I feel too. And I was really, I didn't think about it until we were going to talk about this.
Yeah.
And then I was like, was it just a certain time in American history that like, kids were maybe interacting with nature more. I have no idea, but it seems like this is like every coming of age story for a certain time, like the big symbol of loss of innocence, which makes sense, is right. the death of a beloved animal.
Right.
And right. you like cry and it's horrible.
Right. And I feel like also, I'm trying to remember pull out all of my history tools from my toolbox, but like, I feel like the worries of industry and like yeah. modern life were looming too. So it's like this kind of sentimental look back on the importance of that relationship between people and nature, which I feel like Marjorie was very much about in mm-hmm. the way she moved through the world.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely a very natural element to everything that she does. And I mean, farming and all, you know, there's this rural and natural element to everything that she seemed. I mean, I didn't read every word she wrote, but from what I can tell.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I mean, I think this really kind of set the tone for that subgenre of that genre, right? That whole mm-hmm. like dead animal kind of genre. But as our guest says in our interview, you know, it's probably the best version of that. I haven't sat down and like critically examined them all, but this is a Pulitzer Prize winning version of that, right? And does just, you know, and also just, you know, not every book, just because a book has a young protagonist, I think we should not always jump to the conclusion that it's only for kids. She's kind of made me want to read this again.
Yeah. Well, that actually makes me, well, first of all, that's a great point. And I think that's a conversation. I know that's a conversation that's still happening mm-hmm. around YA today and the stigma. First of all, what does it mean to be labeled as YA? Does like a lot of times that has a negative connotation in terms that's of right. like, this is for, you know, younger minds that are not as developed, which of course is not the case.
No.
And so that's a really interesting point to bring up. And then, yeah, when did you first read The Yearling?
I'm pretty sure like in grade school too, like her, yeah. you know, our guest talks a little bit about, you know, the teacher reading this book to her class pretty early. And I think this is also a real disadvantage of this book and probably things like Where the Red Fern Grows and other books like it. In a sense, because you kind of go like check somewhere. I already like encountered this book. I'm done with it. And it was when I was young. And like, on the one hand, that means a lot of people are exposed to it pretty early and that's cool. But then they kind of like go all set, don't need to revisit that. And yeah. that's probably a little bit of a bummer for this book because you kind of yeah. just go like, yeah, some teacher read it to me at some point, the end, yeah. You know, and, yeah. and that's kind of it. And I don't really remember. It's like, I mean, I have to say for the dead pet trick that like, it really sticks with you.
Yeah.
So what you remember is like, oh, dead deer. Like, kid, dead deer, done. Boom. And yeah, I just think it's kind of interesting to think about revisiting some of these things that we were all exposed to really early in our lives. On the other hand, I think it's great that kids like have this really relatable story that they can, you know, and the emotional stakes feel, you know, right for that age too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's great. And that you are exposed to great literature featuring someone kind of like you early in your life is also lovely. So, but you know, this is between being a woman and writing this seminal book seen as for young people, you know, I think it does mean you end up having to sort of fight a little more for her legacy.
Yeah. Yes. That's such a great point too. And thankfully, Anne McCutcheon, our guest today, did have an experience with that as a young person and then decided to, you know, revisit Marjorie in a really interesting way in her book, The Life She Wished to Live. So I'm really excited for listeners who either have or haven't read The Yearling to revisit that story and listen to our interview with Anne McCutcheon.
Our guest today is Anne McCutcheon, who has written 6 books of memoir, essay, and biography. Her newest book, The Life She Wished to Live, a biography of Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, author of The Yearling, was published by W.W. Norton in May 2021. The founding director of the University of Wyoming's MFA in Creative Writing Program and former editor of American Literary Review, McCutcheon grew up in Florida and now lives in Southern Wyoming. Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, Anne McCutcheon.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We'll start with the very basic question, which is, what drew you to write a biography on Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings?
I'll try to make a long story short. first, I grew up in Florida, and my fourth grade teacher read The Yearling to us every day after lunch. So over some weeks, we 9-year-olds heard all of The Yearling. And it's a favorite memory of mine. She was a real cracker lady teaching fourth grade in Pompano Beach, Florida. And most of us were Yankee transplants who, you know, just landed in South Florida. So we didn't know anything about the state. But if you fast forward to about 12 years ago, I met a couple in Texas, where I was living at the time, who had a residency program, one person, one writer at a time, who was writing on something to do with the environment. And I was chosen to go out there to this remote place for West Texas for 2 months, and I was working on another book. And I discovered that these benefactors, they're philanthropists who had established this residency, the husband was from Florida. And we just hit it off talking about Florida and, you know, so on, bringing back lots of memories. A year later, he died, and his widow asked me to help box up her husband's environmental library, which was vast. And she offered me all of his Florida books, and I took them, including everything Marjorie ever wrote. Sometime later then, she came to me with the idea of writing this biography. She said, I think you're the perfect person to do it. There is not one out there. And she offered some financial support to start it, and a substantial, which was mind blowing. And so it was as if an old passion, an old interest had been carried into the way into the future, and it met its benefactor, if you will. It was a great literary match, I thought. At least, you know, her idea coming, you know, having a bright idea to invite me to consider it, and boy, I did. I loved it. Yeah,
that is so wonderful, and we could really tell you loved it. I mean, reading this book, we feel so close to Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, like the details, like every bit of, you know, her letters and. It's just an intimate portrait. And I have another question related to that. I mean, you do such a beautiful job teasing out Marjorie's early life, all of her life, but really her early life. Yeah. You paint a really beautiful portrait of the environment she grew up in and her family. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about her upbringing and how her relationships with her family members, specifically Ida, her mother, which is so many feelings reading all of that. But yeah, how those relationships in her early life really affected her outlook on her work and her life.
Sure. I'll talk about her father first, who was a rather gentle soul. Both parents came from the Midwest farm families, so they had that in common. And coming to Washington, D.C. in the big city was something they both wanted to try. So Arthur Kanan, her father, worked in government and was an attorney, or a patent lawyer, I should say. But he really, really missed the outdoors and farming. That was really so in his blood. And so when Marjorie was, 7, 8, something like that, he bought farmland in Garrett Park, Maryland, which is actually near where I grew up my first few years. And he had a farm. He established a farm, and he had dairy cows and crops, and he'd go out there in the weekend. He was a weekend farmer, but he had someone to help him, and he took Marjorie with him, and he offered her that love of the land, of nature, and camping out there, and that she always credited her father with that love of the natural environment. Her mother was socially ambitious, okay? They got to Washington, D.C. She thought maybe she would be inter-society in some way, which didn't quite happen, although she gave a few teas that got a little bit in the newspaper. But she became very ambitious for her daughter, wanted her to succeed, a stage mother, if you will, and so pushed her in, singing lessons, dancing lessons, and let's hit it, let's find the talent. And the talent turned out to be writing. And so she encouraged her in every way. She wanted Marjorie to be rich and marry well, as they say, some senator or college president, you name it. She wanted her daughter to have that kind of fancy life, along with being a literary success. And so there was a lot of friction there. If you're a creative person, naturally, the last thing you want is someone hitting on you to be creative. So that there was always that tension between mother and daughter. No doubt that the mother's encouragement helped in some ways. Enter another contest. She kept doing it. At the same time, she felt pushed. And old story, I think, between talented people and ambitious parents, mother or father. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Marjorie got into some hot water more than once for writing unflattering portraits of real life people in her books, for Jacob's Ladder as well as Cross Creek. Mm-hmm. And for the latter, she was hit with a $100,000 lawsuit for invasion of privacy. Right. Can you talk a little bit about this, the outcome, and how culpable was Marjorie really?
Oh, I can't judge that. I read the 82 words, I think, that were brought into question and read and reread over 5 years that lawsuit dragged on. And I find them, the portrait of Zelma Kaysen to be quite charming and vivid, let's say. Mm-hmm. There had been some tension between the two of them almost 10 years before. Both women were strong-willed. Zelma Kaysen had a really salty tongue, even for Cross Creek, which is saying a lot. And there are some letters from that time which between the two of them that I gathered that they'd had come to some tough discussion. And one can speculate, there was also the idea that is out there that Zelma was jealous of Marjorie's friendship with another person there. Anyway, you could say it was a quarrel between hens that just got out of control. But it's worse than that. I mean, Zelma was jealous of Marjorie's success. Everybody would agree on that. And some sources say she wanted some of that money that Marjorie was getting from the yearling, especially. You've read the book, you know there are lots of theories about why that dragged on, but it ended Marjorie's writing life to do with Florida. She never wrote about Florida again. It was 5 years of heartache and heartbreak and expense, and she felt betrayed by Zelma Kaysen. It was all over the newspapers, all over the Florida papers. Reporters swept in from time to time to write about these colorful characters in this backwater that were having such a snit. And anyway, maybe I won't go on.
It is dead writer drama after all. We love it.
Yeah. Well, you may recall there was a big courthouse trial. I mean, there were things before the courthouse trial and after. And in the end, nobody won anything. It was a legal stalemate, if you will, although there was a decision. But the week that the public trial went on at the Alachua County Courthouse, that I can just see the film of that. That's, you know, people with their lunches and picnic baskets and sitting in this hot, sweaty room with the fans going and hearing one local after another, you know, talking about these two women, you know, so.
Yeah. And I have to know, like, how much of that, because I'm thinking about her in today's world and like, I feel like regionalism now feels a little stronger, and the fact that she wasn't from Florida, right? Yeah. And she's spinning these, you know, really fun stories that people were enjoying. But was there also a little bit of that of like, you are this transplant who is kind of taking these stories? And again, that's like my modern, like, what if, is this kind of, you know, taking advantage and using these things and in that kind of way? Was there that element in terms of like why it also hurt her image? Or
no,
am I just, yeah.
No, no, that wasn't an issue then.
Yeah.
That during the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration, a lot of government entities were trying to put people to work, but one of the things that they did, which was really timely, was sending writers and other journalists and so forth out to document, chronicle little-known corners of the U.S. and interviewing people, photographing people, let us now praise famous men, that right. sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so she was of that period where it was here, you know, you brought this corner of Florida to life and to literary notice, and that wasn't an issue. Interesting that it is now. The seas change every so many years, but I think she did. I should also say that Florida doesn't have a lot of natives.
It's true.
We all came from somewhere else.
Yeah. Very true.
You know, even the backwoods folks she was speaking to had come down from, their lineage went back to, you know, Georgia, West Virginia. I mean, people had moved there from somewhere else, unless you were Native American. So Florida's full of transients.
Yes, for sure. And speaking of Florida, you've written a bit in other works as well about Florida and the South. Yes. What is it about that region that inspires you, either personally or creatively? And how do you think that compares with what inspired Marjorie?
Ooh, I don't know. Let's see. She came from the outside. She'd been there once, and then she just said, I'm going, and jumped off a cliff, if you will, and just put herself there and went to learn, opened herself to the place. I came down as a Yankee transplant in the late 50s, as many did, and many still do. But I keep writing about it. I've written a memoir of growing up there. And by God, I'm writing another personal essay about that time, too, right now. Because I lived there 20 years, I guess, from age 5 to going off to grad school, it's still in my bones, as much as I like to say, well, I'm not really from there. I am too. And what's fascinating about that place is it is full of people from other places. It's kind of weird, actually. People in the 50s and early 60s that I remember about would come down there and open a motel, and they would call it the Ohio Motel or the Michigan Motel from where they came. And there, people bringing their baggage with them. I mean, good baggage, you know. So it's just kind of a melting pot, although sometimes it doesn't feel like it's melted enough. I don't know. Hope that answers. I have a fondness for it. After wanting to get the hell out, I enjoy writing about it because there's no place like it.
Kind of relatedly, how do you think those other places that she lived, like Wisconsin and New York and Kentucky, influenced her work?
They were, I don't know if you could say, well, the work she did in those places helped her, let's say. In Wisconsin, she got a good literary education. She had a professor who called her on flowery language that her mother encouraged. Too many adjectives, you know, clean it up. That was a good lesson. She in New York as a publicist, and in Louisville and Rochester as a journalist, she learned to write tight and focused and quick and on a deadline. That's how I started, and you cannot put a price on that. There's a discipline, there's a clarity, and so once she got to the point where she could do creative work and had the freedom, or she thought orange growing would be such a easy thing, and it wasn't. But she had these skills to start with, including editing skills. You self-edit a lot when you're a journalist. You've got to fit everything into, 600 words or 1,200 or something. So she was efficient, although she often missed deadlines because her creative work was taking 6 months longer or something. But we all know what that's like with a book project. So I think those were good years for her, good learning years. Mm-hmm. Not to project or anything.
And speaking of writers tied to Florida, Marjorie was also friends with Zora Neale Hurston.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship? We covered Zora many, many moons ago, Jennifer. I can't remember when.
It was our first one.
It was our first one. Oh, yes. My God. Yes. So, yeah, just can you share a little bit about their relationship and how they met?
They met in the summer of, I think it was 1941. I'll have to look it in my book to make sure I know.
Go buy the book, everyone. Go buy the book and look yourself.
Yes.
Get me a copy, too. Zora was teaching, speaking at a school in St. Augustine that summer, and Marjorie attended a lecture that she gave and was really impressed, really blown away. She had never met a Black woman of her literary stature, an equal, you know, to her. And so she befriended her and asked her to come to tea or coffee or wine. I think it ended up being wine. At her husband's hotel. Marjorie's husband ran a big hotel in St. Augustine. So Zora did. There was a little kerfluffle about getting a Black woman into a wealthy white person's hotel. But it worked out, and this is what happened. Marjorie's husband set an assistant to come out and meet Zora outside the hotel and rush her through the lobby so that the white clientele would not see her. But Zora knew these conventions all too well, and she let herself in through the back of the hotel, through the kitchen, where the kitchen staff was, and they showed her up to where she should meet Marjorie for tea. That was how they first got together socially. They had a ball. Marjorie's husband called up and said, we haven't seen her. And Marjorie said, she made her way up here. Come on, we're having a great time. So they bonded immediately, just having a great time, talking about books and so forth. Wish we really had that conversation somewhere, but it sealed the deal. And so they became friends. It was what I call the come to Jesus moment for Marjorie, who had, let's say, conventional racial prejudices of the time. Here's Cora. She had a black staff at her farmhouse. She paid everyone more than the going rate. She covered medical expenses and things like that, which made her white neighbors mad. At the same time, though, they were under her, and more than just as employees, she saw them socially as lesser. When she met Zora, bang, okay, real people. And she took about a year and a half of just soul searching, and I'm sorry, Cora. And it's all documented in letters to her husband, who was in the American Field Service at the time. So she's going through this and exchanging letters with her husband, telling him what she was going through. Anyway, to me, that's a fascinating chapter of her life. And I'll tell you, honestly, I knew the issue would come up. I did not know what I was going to find. I knew about the friendship with Zora, but I did not know what else would take place within Marjorie. And when I came across the letters to her husband and saw that how much she was wrestling with her racial prejudice, I thought, oh, thank you. My subject is got enlightened, if you will, for the times, and I have a lovely story to tell. I don't have to apologize for her, and she is an example of I think what a lot of white people might have been going through at that time and still do. So anyway,
that's another thing I would love to see on the screen, just like that friendship. Oh, that would be
absolutely so. That's really true. And I mean, I also really relate to what you're talking about on a more practical level, like the feeling of finding those letters, right? And like having that, because so many, you know, sometimes you just don't get that psychological explanation that you're hoping to get. And letters can be so wonderful for that.
It was a treasure to read those letters.
You know, it's interesting because there's this other woman named Beatrice, who is one of her staff, who is the black woman, and people might even know from the movie, the movie Maid of Cross Creek, played by Alfred Woodard. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, that dynamic and that relationship in relation to this other one?
Well, I can tell you more about Idella Parker than Geechee, who was not on the scene as long, but she's in the movie.
Right.
I'm really sorry. I'm not prepared for this one.
We could just skip it.
Totally fine.
Never happened.
You've got
so much information up here. Like, don't worry
absolutely.
About it.
Absolutely. We can just move on to our next question.
Or I can talk about Idella, who was her maid, assistant, even amanuensis for a number of years, on and off. And Marjorie once called her perfect maid. She was the one of her housekeeping staff that had been educated and could read. So she could read the yearling, and she understood what, you know, what Marjorie was about. At the same time, Marjorie didn't always treat her well. And so she'd leave. Or she'd find a better job somewhere else and go off for, you know, and take that for a year. And so, but Marjorie always wanted her to come back, and she did until she didn't. And so this went on for, gosh, 8 or 9 years. It was a very close relationship between these two women. Idella wrote two books, two memoirs, and I should say with the assistance of someone else who would maybe, you know, tape what she was saying, and then they would edit stuff. And she was quite revered and loved around Cross Creek, you know, brought back to talk and talk about Marjorie. But that was a really close relationship between, she wasn't more and much more than a maid, although she always wore a uniform. I mean, can you imagine? No. It's tiny, you know, where there's no one coming to see you. She still shows up, has to show up in a uniform. So, gosh, customs.
Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in your book, right at the beginning, in fact, you show some pages of the yearling from her typewritten drafts, which is so fun, I think, for anybody, but especially writers to see, full of edits and everything. What did you learn as a writer from studying these and looking through her pages?
Oh, I felt so good. I thought, I just loved seeing the process of, you know, a word scratched out and another one substituted and going, yeah, that's a better word, you're right. Or a whole sentence, you know, taken out because it was too much. The paragraph needed to be collapsed just a bit. I could see those changes, and we all make them, or should be making them when we're writing a big piece. And so just to see the work in progress, if you will, I mean, it's, you know, it's an amber now, but to see that as much as you could of the process on paper was wonderful. They were messy drafts. and what she left might not really be the first one. Who knows?
That's right.
First draft, a yearling, well, first full draft, but how many separate chapters and you know, scenes hit the floor and made it to the wastebasket before that first full draft came about? I don't know.
It's so cool. And it's so humanizing to see those mistakes and to see them all just in front of you like that, and humbling, I think, too.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hard really work.
Yeah. I love that. The yearling is a landmark of the young adult genre, even though it wasn't called that yet. What do you think its legacy is?
I would hope that it's legacy gets bigger. It's an adult novel. It was after the movie was made and was touted as, you know, family friendly and good for kids and all of that, that the book then fell into this sort of children's book category, which is not so. I mean, because it revolves around a young boy, a coming of age story, but it's a highly literary novel. It's, the prose is gorgeous. Everything about it is beautiful. And so I hope it makes it out of YA. I hope it's not really in YA. Yeah. I hope people of all ages are reading it. I would hope that if this biography has any power at all, that it will lead people to her books, and that the yearling will be identified more widely as a novel for everyone. Whoops. I'm sorry. You can't have your... She thinks... This is Cora Marjorie Rawlings, my my Australian shepherd, who's just giving me her dish to
she just wanted to chime in on the legacy of her namesake.
She agrees.
Yes.
So you have to wait.
That's okay. We're almost close. We're on our last question, and then we just have a lightning round. And we promise.
We're in another room.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. No problem.
Okay.
Stay here. Oh, so cute. I'm jealous. So jealous.
I know. I said the same thing.
Okay.
No. She's like, I know you're not done talking about Marjorie yet. the yearling, going back to what you were saying about it being kind of put away as this YA book, like you forget, or I forgot that it was, you know, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1939. Mm-hmm. It was a bestseller and was a Book of the Month Club pick, which I didn't know was around for like almost 100 years. And so all of those things, it's really interesting to think about how it's been put in that kind of box when really everyone was reading it in 1938. Yes, they were. After that.
Yep.
So going off of that, I mean, how did winning the Pulitzer Prize affect Marjorie's career?
Well, it got her some income as a writer. She'd been struggling to that point, struggling to make that Orange Grove work. Her first novel, South Moon Under, was well reviewed and sold well, but it did not make her self-sufficient, I suppose. And it was that novel that broke her, or it was the last straw for her husband, who the marriage. Mm. Broke when she became a success. How about that?
I've never heard that before.
So the yearling then did bring her a substantial income, and she became a public figure. She was asked to appear here and there, to write a piece, submit a piece to this or that, One of the biggest impacts was on her writing place self. Mm. People started driving down to Cross Creek to find her. Mm. Just come motoring up and discover, you know, they asked directions from every little gas station and come motoring up to her farmhouse and want to just walk through the gate. And here's where Idella did a great service. She'd go out and tell them, you know, I'm sorry, Miss Rawlings is sick. You know, we can't have this. Eventually, Marjorie bought herself a beach house at Crescent Beach, south of St. Augustine, so she could get away from Cross Creek and the fans who were, trailing her, which is too bad. But it really opened up her social life. It gave her a national face. She was a guest at the White House, things like that, that sort of burnished her career and changed it forever. Yeah.
That's great. So we're going to go into our lightning round here at the end. You can just give us your quick instinctive answers here. If Marjorie Kennan Rawlings' life were to be dramatized and you got to pick the medium, which would you choose? Feature film, biopic, HBO miniseries, or in-depth podcast series?
Biopic, probably. Mm. Yeah. Well, what was your third choice?
In-depth podcast series.
Okay, but there was another one. Oh, well, yeah, biopic or a series, perhaps.
Yeah.
Six episodes or something like that. Mm-hmm. I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah, visually, just seeing her out in nature, and there's just so much that could be fun.
We need that Florida. We need that Florida vibe.
Yeah. What would Marjorie's pandemic project be?
Another novel.
Just a workaholic. That's all.
Yeah.
I love it.
I don't think we've gotten that answer before.
That's a perfect answer. It's like, why wouldn't that be it? Which, if any, form of social media would she have used? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
That's tough because she was always fighting for her privacy. And it's hard to imagine her in modern times now with all of that. But probably Facebook, and she would have someone else do it.
No,
she wouldn't. She would not herself put things up.
Right. It would just be like the book news and that kind of thing. Is that what it would be?
Marjorie's appearing here, you know, photographs of her speaking at a college or something, but she would not actually do the work. She would hire someone to keep that Facebook presence
going. I love that. Also an answer we have somehow not gotten yet. So
yeah, yes. And our last question of the lightning round is, which work of hers, besides The Yearling, which of course has been adapted a few times in lots of different ways that I hadn't even heard of until we were getting into this interview. Yeah. So which work besides The Yearling would make the best modern movie or TV adaptation, in your opinion?
I am partial to The Sojourner, which is her last novel, and not set in Florida, set in Michigan farmland. Although she wrote it in New York State farmland, and I visited the house where she wrote that book. She bought a house up there after that lawsuit. She said, "I'm getting the hell out of Florida." And she still had Cross Creek, but she bought a house in upstate New York and wrote there. And when I went to that house, I went, "There's a setting of The Sojourner." She took it. Here it is, but it's Michigan. I mean, it could be. Anyhow, it's a wonderful novel centered on a man who is introspective and sensitive. He's a farmer. And has a lot of things to family members to deal with, a very exuberant wife who doesn't quite understand him, kids who, you know, the generation coming up were more materialistic than he, a mother who he has to support, but keeps comparing him to the other brother who is off in Seattle. Anyway, there are a lot of relationships that this man has to deal with, and I think it's a wonderful book. It's not a Florida book, but he would be a great hero, and
that's great.
A lot of interesting characters around him.
Maybe like a 10-part Netflix adaptation, because you know you can get into all the different character relationships then, and really exploit the setting. So
that's a really good idea.
There we go.
Done. Okay, you're done. Let's propose it to somebody.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was lovely. Can people find you somewhere online?
Yes, the website. It's just annemccutcheon.com.
Wonderful. And everyone, please check out the biography. It's really lovely. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking me. Bye-bye.